Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense. We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, infographics, relevant links, book suggestions, or just to leave comments. Follow us on Twitter at @SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Pero caliente, muchachos.
Y muchachas, sí.
Ooh, is this your first show? Sorry. Our introductions are going to take a little bit of getting used to, but you are in luck. This is indeed an English language production. I don't know. Sometimes I just get excited and I start blurting things out in Spanish. I need to be more responsible. You can't just go shouting things in Spanish whenever you feel like it. That's not how we're going to make America great again. Is it?
Good morning, everybody. This is Brett. It is 10 a.m. on 11-12-15. Hey, so this is actually, this is future Brett from the Brett you're about to hear in today's podcast. On the show today, you will hear past Brett, early morning Brett, waking up as the production begins. And then I think I'm pretty lively by the end of it. So I hope you enjoy this discussion. I recorded this conversation first thing this morning with Lorette Lynn, a follow-up to our last discussion. I have to apologize. I had a lot of show prep, a lot of things I wanted to go over. Didn't really get to any of it. So that will be upcoming in a future production. I wanted to expand on some of the things I talked about in the introduction to the last show, episode 380, Visible Children, relating to internal family systems and the seven types of inner critics. Conversation went in another direction, and that's totally fine. And on a serious note, got a call from a friend who lives across the country, halfway across the country the other night, and he was a little bit distressed. This is actually somebody I used to work with, collaborate with on podcasting. And he just put his boy in school, you know, in the first grade. And he was really, really frustrated with his son's condition when he comes home from school each day, feeling really demoralized by that experience, you know, trailing behind some kids in some areas and feeling like, well, the school puts pressure on him to get into the mold with everybody else. And that is translating to pressure on the parent, my friend. My friend is an outdoorsman. He's taken a six-year-old boy out into the woods. They've gone fishing. They've done projects together. So here this little fella is with all of this real-world success, right? Cause and effect, solving problems, using his hands, using his body, suddenly finding himself in a situation where he has to sit almost completely still for what must seem like to him almost the entire day. Strange, not strange, how my friend's desire to have this young child experience life wound up setting him up to fail in school. What could my friend have done differently to make this boy ready for the experience of first grade in a public school? Well, instead of all of these activities where he's out there gaining a sense of self-efficacy, he could have had him practice sitting still and being quiet, maybe, since he was 4 years old. That would have put him in a much better position to be successful in government school. So our conversation went on for a while, and in the end, he decided, and he wanted my input on this, that maybe the best move would be to move his son to another school, a private school, where there's more one-on-one attention, where kids have control over their day. I obviously endorsed that. I thought it was a great idea. Home education right now, not an option for his family. So we talked through some ideas and came up with a solution. But in this conversation that you're going to hear today with Lorette, it's more than just this problem that I just described with my friend of taking a young boy from a meaningful world to him, where these great experiences of success are readily available as long as he applies and asserts himself, to this meaningless world. Like, that sucks enough on its own. But then add to that the enforcement
of the importance of that perceived meaninglessness and the tragic effects that it has on, you know, a small child. I'm glad I was able to talk to my friend. I think he was already well on his way to a solution, and I was glad that I could provide a little bit of reinforcement for what he already wanted to do. Hey, I want to say thanks to everybody for participating in a thread that I started about a week ago for your guest suggestions. It's in the School Sucks group on Facebook. Join our group if you want to participate in some very lively discussion and you want to get news about the show as it happens. Last couple of days have brought a lot of news related to the show. So I encourage you to go and check it out and tell me who you want to hear on this podcast. I got some great suggestions. I made a list. I'm looking for more. Check the actual thread. There's a criteria, a certain range of topics that I'm looking to cover. And thanks to everybody who's just in that group generally. You know, whether you come for serious discussions or to provide meaningful feedback, or even if you're just there to ham it up with your pals. Oh, gosh. All right, so here's my follow-up conversation with Laurette Lynn. More stuff coming very soon. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great weekend. Recorded a show last week that I titled on SchoolSucksProject.com, Visible Children. The goal of our show was to talk about, from our own experiences, what we had found to be the most helpful ways of communicating with young people at different ages. But in that conversation, we also did some exploration of what medium and long-term consequences are of not communicating that way, of communicating more hostily, or what are the results of the communication children usually have to endure inside the school. And in the introduction to that show, I expanded on that idea a little bit, using some work that a couple colleagues and past contributors to School Sucks had talked about on their show, the Powerful Parenting Podcast. This idea that the way children are spoken to when they're young becomes really an inner voice as they grow. And there were seven types of inner critic, according to the psychologist Jay Early, that develop. I actually, over the weekend, I did a show with some of my friends. It's a bonus show. It won't appear in the regular podcast feed, where we went through all seven, and we talked about which ones we had. So since I recorded that monologue, I've learned a little bit more about myself, which is good, and my friends. But what were your thoughts when you heard the intro to the show?
Well, as always, I thought that it was very articulate and insightful on your part. I think that you have an amazing gift to see beneath the surface of a situation and realize what's going on. I do agree that situations do create an inner monologue. The issue with communication, but and the reason why this field fascinates me so much is because it underlines everything that goes on in the world. Anything that's put into motion, any action that is always taken, always begins with rhetoric. It begins with the way we're communicating our thoughts and ideas into the world. And most of the time that happens through language. Of course, we have body language and other ways of communicating, but language is the most prominent form of communicating. The words that we use can build up or can destroy. And we don't realize sometimes just how powerful of a tool our words are, especially with children. And children, I do realize that children are human beings, and of course there's no reason to create a distinction there. As far as respect is concerned, they deserve just as much respect as anybody else in the world deserves. However, developmentally, there is a physiological difference in a teenager or the brain of a young person than an adult. We still maintain plasticity as an adult, but there is a physiological difference. So children are actually formidable. That's why I've said before that school is a dangerous place for a child to be during the most formidable years of their lives. They're still in a stage where they're understanding and discovering their world, and they're very heavily relying on the people that came before them, aka adults, to help them form their opinions about the world, even if it's in contrast to what the adults are doing. So if we're in a position where we're asserting some kind of authority over children from the get-go, we're allowing them to believe that there is authority over them. We're teaching them right away that they don't matter and that their voices don't matter and that they need to assert themselves if they want to get any kind of respect. So we're teaching them this kind of violence in return for more violence, and we're perpetuating the circle. So I think that the intro that you gave and the conversation that we had, when we were having it, it flowed very naturally, and we're both intelligent people. We were able to have the discussion, but listening back to it, I was realizing that it is so much more powerful than even we thought it was. It's a conversation that I wish more people would have, because it's important. The way children are, the experience that they have when they're growing up dictates the future that they have,
yeah.
And therefore that dictates the society, the future of society that we're looking at.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the distinction between children at different ages is really important as well. The way children are handled or treated or spoken to at very young ages, you have this unfortunate effect of scaring them, traumatizing them, even if it's severe enough. But with teenagers, where most of my professional experience was, both in a boarding school as a teacher and then working as basically, I sometimes call it a door-to-door tutor, where, you know, I would just drive from one place to another and try to put out academic fires or provide standardized test tutoring, is that same communication, if it continues into those years, pushes young people, teenagers, away from adults. And, you know, this is one of John Taylor Gatto's warnings about the schooling process, you know, is that it's basically alienating kids from the real adult world. And there was this television special that aired. People can find it on YouTube. It's called A Different Kind of Teacher. I've definitely used clips of it on the show before. But it's actually like a feature story on John as a teacher. And it basically, it's interesting. It must have been like really, really right before he put in his resignation, where he's basically bending school rules to get kids out of the building and get them interacting with adults in positive and constructive ways. So he's sending these two girls off to somewhere, you know, they were in Manhattan, and he sends them off somewhere downtown to work for this trucking company. Just like in the middle of the school day. And these kinds of connections, these positive interactions with adults are so much better as far as preparing them for the real world than this top down relationship that they have to endure in school. But because of the milieu of school, I mean, that communication, what we're warning people about, is par for the course, and putting kids into these cooperative relationships with adults is really healthy, is certainly compared to what people just accept as normal in those schools. And I remember being a teacher and restructuring the program. And I could tell that story, you know, as like some kind of visionary. Like, I saw what was wrong and I proposed these solutions and got these results. But as I've said elsewhere, I think I was just really lazy about doing things that I thought sucked.
Mm-hmm.
I had losing battle after losing battle, basically trying to get obedience from these students. And I shifted the curriculum to basically this life skills curriculum where we all worked together on a newspaper. And to choose cooperation over obedience or self-responsibility over what schools so often ask of kids, which is surrender, you know, that made my job much better, much more enjoyable. And I think that all I could say that I really identified at the time was this must suck for all of these kids, this environment, these demands. And as a result, it sucks for me. And that's something that I'd like to change. And I wonder how many teachers have those feelings, especially in the public schools, where the structure or the expectations are so much more rigid. They want to. I mean, I don't think they go to work to butt heads with kids, but it happens over and over again because it doesn't seem like there's any way out of that trap.
I don't think any person that aspires to become a teacher does so because they are just mean-spirited people. As the words are coming out of my mouth, I'm thinking, I don't know, maybe they are, because there are damaged people in the world, and the system actually, unfortunately, creates damaged people. So maybe there's a small percentage of teachers that feel that going into that career or following that path for their lives may allow them a sense of power or feeling of power. And, you know, that probably is true, unfortunately, that we do have a percentage of teachers that are doing it simply because they need to fill some kind of personal need for power or assertion over another person. And unfortunately, the system is designed to allow for that. So maybe there are teachers that go into the field for that. But I think the majority of people that become teachers do so for what they think are noble reasons at the time that they make the decision. They want to make a difference in the world. They like working with youth, and they feel like they can make a positive impact and have a positive difference. I think that what happens sometimes is as they go on in years, they realize, like you did, this environment is suffocating. It doesn't really benefit children in the creative ways that they had hoped. They, in turn, feel suffocated because they cannot do their job or really realize their potential in the way that they originally thought they could. And they, you know, they either end up getting beaten up by the system itself, or like you and many other teachers, they end up leaving and trying to make a positive impact, like John Telegato, in other ways. And, you know, thank God we have them, actually, because these are the people that are stepping forward and saying, this is the ugly side of it, and I would like to see it change. I know that you've had shows about this, Brett, and I've had shows about this, too. I've had this conversation before. When you begin to peel back the layers, though, and you realize that the system itself, the environment, was created to serve this purpose. It was created to be authoritarian. It was created to be maniacal. The whole reason that the systematic institutionalized school system exists is to suppress children, is to create this training camp, so to speak. So it is difficult to rail against it. It didn't happen by accident. It happened very on purpose. I think the elements that are fighting against it, or the positive elements that we have in our society, are those of us that have recognized it and set out to do something about it. And instead of just shouting about it, we're creating something else. You're tutoring now. We're supporting other initiatives in education. We support home education, or we support alternative means of education and ideas like that. I will tell you that of course, do not work for a school system, but I started working with children teaching public speaking and communication. And I started teaching public speaking communication in the homeschool or home education environment in a co-op, home education co-op. Then it kind of bled outside of that because it was successful, and I was teaching adults and children. And I work with children now on a regular basis in theater as well. And I stage manage, and I help to teach monologues and projection and working with children. I'm going to go back to what you said about how you struggled with obedience. Obedience is a very volatile word, or it can be, when you think about it. It has a negative connotation. When you think obedience, you think dictatorship. But really what you're looking for is cooperation. And I noticed that working with children, if my goal was to get them to be obedient, it is a struggle. Because they are children, but they are also human beings. And human beings, by our very nature, we're going to fight suffocation. We're going to try to breathe. We're going to want to be independent and free. So that's why it becomes a struggle. If your goal, though, if you change your perspective and your goal becomes cooperation, then everything changes. And you realize all you're really looking for is cooperation. You're not demanding just shut up and sit down and listen to what I'm telling you. Instead, it's a conversation. And there have been times where kids have gotten wild where, you know, you kind of just approach it as, okay, come on, guys, I'm trying to do a job here. You're here for a reason. I'm here for a reason. Let's work this out. And if I approach it, maybe not with those words, but with that kind of attitude, then the kids feel empowered. They feel like they do have some control over what happens. And all of a sudden, everything is calmer. Yeah. I do think that if our learning environments operated this way, it would be a lot more healthy. But the problem is, Brett, that I don't think that they're supposed to.
No, and what you just said, I mean, that goes back to one of the original ideas that I presented on this show. We're not trying to remake a schooling system. That's insane. People have to get out, right? Because once this domination system is accepted, once people find themselves inside it, it has to be about obedience over cooperation. Now, I put myself in the shoes of younger me in those classrooms with, you know, kids who had some pretty severe emotional challenges, who were prone to violence. What do I remember being the most powerful emotion for me, trying to run a campus of these teenagers at the age of 24? Fear. I was terrified. You know, it's the exact same reason why Prussian aristocrats wanted to set up a system in the first place. It's the exact same reason why 70 or 80 years later, there were conversations in American academia like, hey, well, maybe we should try eugenics, right? It was terror and it was a fear of losing control. So because it is a domination system, the system doesn't work if the domination isn't there. So forget cooperation, you know, forget mutually beneficial relationships or working together, you know, like learner and mentor. That's not happening there. It can't happen there. And I didn't understand fully what I was doing at the time. It was more than just spitballing. I had a plan for how to remake the school environment that I was in, but it had to be someplace where if one of the students was like, bah, I don't want to do this right now, It wouldn't break the whole environment apart. It was okay. There was something else he could do. I think that...
Did you find, though, that that was the struggle for you to be able to create that kind of environment?
It was an interesting transition. I taught in this school for 2 years. The first year was absolutely awful, where I was trying to basically lead a classroom and have sometimes 8, sometimes 10, sometimes 12 kids all doing the same thing, whether they wanted to do it or not, and to be to avoid disrupting anyone else in the class while they were doing it. And I was setting myself up to fail basically every day, you know, writing lesson plans and then looking at my plan book at the end of the day and saying, oh, that's too bad we didn't get to any of this because we were dealing with behavior problems. It was a miserable, miserable year. And when I went back for the 2003-2004 school year, you know, I had this new plan like, hey, you're all employed at a newspaper. You've got to. And it was basically like the game of life. That was the next school year. It wasn't perfect. You know, it wasn't perfectly harmonious, but they loved it. And they didn't even seem like they ever got tired of it, especially once since we were producing a real product, a school newspaper. And they were the staff of the newspaper, and, you know, everybody in the whole school, like, we were kind of exiled, our campus. These were like the really troubled kids, but they got a lot of acceptance and a lot of compliments that hadn't existed before. And I know there's a problem with, like, you know, seeking the acceptance of others in a sick system that's kind of dismissed you, but they got to experience success. That's what's important through what we were doing. And in my educational career, not counting what I do now, that was probably the best year of my life, that experience.
You know, I enjoy hearing this because I feel like that whenever I listen to stories like this from teachers like you or former teachers like you, I know that there's hope. I do agree that, and I've said this before, I've said it 1,000 times, there really is no fixing this system. It's doing what it's designed to do. It is the nature of the beast. So it really, it's not failing, it's succeeding in creating this atmosphere of authority, because that's what it's designed to do. The way to change it is not to try to fix it from within, because it's not broken according to its design, but to establish other alternatives, to establish something new. And I'm so excited. The last decade has proven that there are so many opportunities out there that people like you and I have created that are establishing something new and different ways to provide children with the opportunity to become educated and exercise their intelligence outside of the oppressive system. And the more talk I hear in the media about how the public education system isn't doing well and how it needs more money or it needs more funding or whatever, that's more proof to me that we are actually succeeding in creating healthier alternatives. So that's good news. You mentioned a couple of key words that sparked my attention, and I just wanted to address them briefly with you.
Sure.
Maybe we could discuss them a little bit, because it just has to do with the way we're communicating and the words that we're using, the power of words. You mentioned success and failure in school, and I think that that is very important, because think about the way success and failure are defined inside of a typical classroom, as opposed to how success and failure is actually defined in real life and in the real world. Failure is seen as the thing to really avoid for students. You don't want to fail. You don't want to get a failing grade. You don't want to get an F. It doesn't create this environment of try and try and try until you succeed. It creates an environment of you have to pass the first time or else you're going to get a bad grade. And that's not good, because it's going to go on your record and you're going to be seen as a failure. And it just has this negative connotation. Whereas in the real world, failure is exactly the thing that eventually leads to success. You have to do all these different things, and you have to try all these different procedures and get them wrong.
Exactly.
Until you find the one that really works. So success and failure are defined very differently in reality than they're defined inside of the classroom. And then you mentioned acceptance, and you kind of doubled back and said, well, even though, you know, you don't want to promote the idea that they need acceptance from a failing system, but that's a problem too. Within the school system, we created this environment where we're telling kids that they need to have this acceptance, but at the same time, we're telling them, well, you don't need anybody else's acceptance. So it's really this constant double standard, and don't worry about what everybody else thinks, but here's what we think of you, and that matters. So
yeah.
It's really very confusing for a child that's in that environment. Meanwhile, when you really look at acceptance for what it is, it's just a very basic human need.
Yeah.
It's okay to want to feel accepted by the people that matter in your life. It's okay. The problem is when we attach all these other measurements to acceptance and we create this confusing environment of you don't need them, but you need us.
Exactly. And, you know, that and the success versus failure, that perfectly relates to this experience that I had. You know, the first year that I taught, it's like, look, all you guys need help. I'm in charge. I know how to read. I know how to math. I know how to science. I know how to history. And if you're quiet and you behave well, I can transmit this knowledge to you. Not really a good setup. And it kind of fits in with the whole power over dynamic of school normally. The second year, we were trying to produce something together from scratch, and we were much more like peers. So this was, like I said, 2003, we started doing this. I had a communications degree, but a lot had changed since I had graduated from college. So we're using new computer programs. Digital photography was relatively new. And, you know, there's lots of times where teenagers were coming to me and saying, Brett, how do I do this? And I don't know. I've never done that before. We'll have to figure it out. And we all started, I mean, I had some idea, like I knew the basic principles of creating a newspaper, but we suddenly had to work together to solve problems. And it was a night and day experience, thinking about what I did the year before. And I also let each person in the class pick the role that they wanted to play, right? So there was I let them, you know, it's tough when you're stuck, you know, because I am still stuck in this system that has these expectations, but they got to choose what they wanted to do. And therefore, there was, you know, some intrinsic motivation as a result.
I think it's okay to say that you let them because you were in a environment or you were in an environment that demanded that kind of behavior. So you had no choice but to kind of play by some of the rules. And I actually applaud you because you developed an environment for the children where you were able to still kind of play by the rules of the system, but you bent them so much and created such flexibility that the children felt like they had some kind of power. So saying that you let them, I mean, I understand that. I don't really condemn you too much for that, but I do get why you're uncomfortable with that word. I'm uncomfortable with that word too, as a matter of fact, and I'm not in high school anymore. I mean, think about the relationships that you have with your spouse or your partner or your girlfriend or your boyfriend or whatever when they say to you, I'm going to let you drive the car today, or I'm going to let you pick dinner for tonight. I mean, it's kind of like, well, really? Are you now? You know, you kind of get defensive about it. So you have to imagine that, of course, especially teenagers, they're not going to feel very good about that when they think that you're just letting them as if you're in control of that. So I do get that vernacular does have a connotation to it. And that's why I say that language is so important. But I think what's most important here is that you found out when you create an environment that is cooperative and when you're able to say, I don't really know the answer to this. Let's find out together. That is so empowering for whether it's a teenager or someone else that you're learning with, whether it's a 10-year-old, even a 6-year-old, to say, you know what? Let's find the answer together. They still have the security of knowing that they're safe, that you're there for them. And okay, maybe I don't know the answer, but I do know how to find the answer and I can help you. So let's find the answer together. So they still have that feeling of safety. Like I'm not just, you know, swimming around on my own here. I still have someone that's backing me up, but I'm in control of finding the answer myself. So it really is the most empowering feeling instead of saying, just sit down and absorb what I'm saying because I know everything. Yeah. And I think that kids, they're just too smart for that. When you have a teacher that says the 30 or 50 of you have to just sit down and I know how to math, I know how to science, I know all the answers to everything, and you just sit there and absorb what I have to say, they know that we're full of shit. We don't know all the answers to everything. All we have is more experience than they do. So when we approach it like that, whether it's a teenager or another human being or someone older than us or whatever, age, we should be age blind when it comes to learning. And just say, you know what? I've been down this road. I have some experience. Let's find the answers together. It's very empowering. And when you allow another person to feel empowered, and you're able to get over your own ego, it creates the most beautiful relationship and wonderfully powerful situation. And I think that's what any environment needs because we're constantly learning.
Contrasted to what most of us experience, and it's not just in school, it's with family as well. All too often, good children are considered to be essentially invisible children. You know, the last episode we did together, I named Visible Children. And in that school environment, especially contrasting the first year I taught with the second year I taught, where the second year, it was very chaotic. You know, no one's in their seats anymore and it doesn't matter. First year, if like something was going on in the classroom and somebody got out of their seat and started walking around, it was like a small crisis. Like, what is this person doing? They're going to disrupt everybody. And then you fast forward 12 months and a lot of the same kids that I taught the year before, you know, they're running around the classroom, like bumping into each other. And there wasn't this expectation anymore that they were going to be labeled good by essentially behaving like animals on a farm, you know, all in the pen that they're supposed to be, not bothering or inconveniencing the humans, which is basically how they're treated in school. So a lot of that, I think, would be, you know, translated to thoughts in these young people's heads. Like, do I even fucking exist? Because the only good thing I can do is to basically be invisible, you know?
That's right. And then when they act on that behavior and feel depressed and feel like they're invisible and feel like they don't matter and they start to exhibit behavior that denotes that, we single them out and we say, why do you feel that way? Don't feel that way. And we say all these superficial, sappy things to them and basically insulting their intelligence because, again, they know we're full of shit when we're saying that stuff. We create the monster and then we tell the monster not to be a monster. It's just this ridiculous system. And I love the picture that you're painting. In my mind's eye, I'm picturing the classroom that you're describing and going back to the idea that you said what you did was you came and you said, we're going to run a newspaper. We're going to be in charge of creating and running this newspaper. Now, Brett, in a real life environment, what do you think? I don't know. There are still newspapers in the world, but I don't know if the offices still run the same way. But I would imagine in a real editorial environment, in a news environment, it's very fast-paced. People are running around. People are bumping into each other. No one in that office is told you better just sit down in your seat and keep on typing because they need the news. They need stuff to happen. It has to be quick-paced. It has to be where people are running around. So you created a very real-life environment. In a typical situation, however, where a child is told you have to just sit down and shut up and listen to what we're telling you because we know everything, that is so unrealistic. And yet we're telling them what we're doing is preparing you for the real world, and we're lying because the real world actually isn't like that. The real world is fast-paced. The real world demands that you act on your own or you're not going to succeed. But then again, is that what the system really wants? Does the system really, was it really designed to build entrepreneurs or was it designed to build workers? And the unfortunate answer is it was designed to build workers because the children that are pegged at 6, 7, and 8 years old in first, second, and third grade, the ones that are designated as potential entrepreneurs and leaders, they're tracked in a very different direction.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
The
six functions of school. Are you familiar with that? The six functions of secondary school. Gatto talks about in several mm-hmm. different places.
Tracking.
Yeah. I think it's called the propodeutic function. And it's basically after the children are sorted, who will be prepared to be the next generation of managers. It was originally conceived in a book called Principles of Secondary Education that was written during the 1910s. By a guy at Harvard named Alexander Inglis. I mean, you can see, like, when Gatto first reports to us about this nefarious plan, you're like, yeah, that's like a little over the top. That was my take on it anyway. But then
it seems nefarious.
Yeah, but well, then you look at the results.
It seems crazy, but then right. But you look at it and you're like, well, wait a minute. This really is happening.
Yeah, exactly. That was definitely my my experience as an observer, and it became more true. Because I didn't even know who Gatto was when I was doing this first job at this boarding school. I had stumbled across him like very briefly, very accidentally when I was in graduate school, and I remember I was doing research for some project that I was working on, and I came across something, and it was like, are the schools dumbing us down? And, you know, I'm there to get my master's degree in education. So I thought that was at least intriguing at the time. I thought I had a fairly like out of the mainstream view of the world because I had gotten revisionist history in college. But, you know, I was also lazy and probably didn't have a lot of time. So I skimmed the page and was like, oh, this doesn't really help me with what I'm trying to do. And it isn't that interesting that some people think school actually works against the educational interests of children. And I closed the page, and that idea just kind of sat in the back of my head. And when I took myself out of graduate school, did this job I described, and then went on to this tutoring world and started to accumulate experience, that quiet idea of a dumbing down conspiracy that just sat there for no other reason than it was intriguing to me, started to grow, right? It started to become louder and louder, and it started to inform more of the experiences that I was having working in and around the public schools, the good public schools, you know, in the competitive greater Boston area. And when I stumbled across Gatto again, just by accident one day in a school library, and I read his article Against School and saw those six functions of education, and then like thought about the students that I was working with, the students that I was going to meet that day, I was like, holy shit. That was the end for me. Every hope that I had for public school, or even really like my career goals related to public school, kind of exploded right there. like in a half an hour, it happened. You know, and there was a mm-hmm. confluence of other experiences, like being in graduate school and doing some of the work and failing to make significant changes. After I left the boarding school, things reverted back to exactly what was easiest for the authorities. They changed everything. And I went back and visited like a year later, and it was like I was never there. So, you know, it was.
Right. And it's unfortunate.
Yeah.
But you're creating something positive outside of that, Brett. I mean, you're part of a growing movement to create alternatives. And there was a time where I existed in this kind of extreme paradigm where I, you know, you're either in school or you're home educated and that's it. But I do realize now that just like different methods of home education, there are other alternatives. And I'm very grateful and thankful that these are existing in the world. Going back to having a hard time accepting that this is the reality, I there were a lot of realities that I have been exposed to since I became a parent and since I became politically aware and politically active that I had a really hard time accepting and a really hard time swallowing. And when I think back now, I think the truths that I had the hardest time accepting were the ones that were presented in language that was just too much or too shocking for me. So it really does come down to the way that we're communicating, the way we're communicating with each other, this conversation that we're having right now. When it's presented in a way that challenges everything that we believe, it's that logic center that is triggered, and we're automatically looking for contrast. We're looking for conflict, and our ego doesn't want to admit that everything we think we already know might be wrong. So we will protect our ego at any cost, even if it's ridiculous. And sometimes we need ideas to really sink in before they make sense to us and before we're able to come to terms with it. I've learned that if I change the vernacular, depending upon who I'm having the conversation with, if I change my phraseology and if I'm very careful about the words I use, it does help to move the conversation forward so that you don't have that immediate red flag from the other person that says, you know, you're saying crazy things, I'm not going to listen to you anymore. And I think it really does depend on who you're speaking with. Now, you and I have both had time to digest a lot of these ideas and realize the unfortunate truth in them, but I'm just going to add something to this conversation.
Sure.
I think a lot of people are shocked because they think, well, we're in a time in our history when we have all these wonderful things and technologies and these things just don't happen. But they do. And this is nothing new. Now, you've studied history, Brett.
Mm-hmm.
I know that you know your history. If we think back as early as ancient Rome, and I always go back to ancient Rome because that really does exemplify the control over a society. And we can look at that as a success gone wrong or a failure from the beginning. And we all know, you know, that it was a dictatorship, but they used these methods on their people. Controlling education, controlling information, being very careful about what the people knew and careful about what they didn't know.
Yeah.
This is not a new concept. Leaders and governments and heads of states have always used information control methods. So a education system really is a system by which children are given information. So of course it's going to be purposeful and deliberate. When you extract yourself and look at the landscape and realize that, yeah, that's all it is. It's a controlling of information, and it's nothing new. This has been going on since the beginning of history.
Yeah.
So how do we combat it? We step outside of it, and we create something better.
Absolutely. It has to be done, right? So just trying to whittle away at the existing system is going to ultimately, I believe, be a failure. You can trace the school system that people are sending their children to on November 11th, 2015, back to Sparta. You know,
yeah.
I mean, our system is definitely Prussian in origin as far as how the environment is set up and as far as some of the overarching goals. It got the whole, you know, progressive makeover in the first couple decades of the 20th century. But the Prussians took their system. I mean, they didn't just, you know, conceive that overnight. They looked at what their goals were, you know, regionally, politically, socially, culturally. And they said, who's had success doing this before?
You know, they had to go all the way back to one of the most militaristic societies that had ever existed, almost 2,000 years before they were searching for answers for how they could, you know, prevent their pawns on the chessboard from running away from gunfire. But that's where they found it. And that's in many important ways, as far as the properties of the system, we still have that today. So I think that... In one of the Gatto videos that I made, where he reads his resignation letter, he talks about this religious idea that school perpetuates, that human genius is a very finite thing, that it sets up this power over dynamic, like the one we've talked about, like most people are incredibly stupid and useless. And I'm really, you know, I hate to sound cynical. This is still an idea that I'm like really, really fighting against. I don't want to believe that. Or I still want to believe in the potential of people, the untapped potential of people. There is a lot of evidence these people, even if you just spend a day, you know, watching the news or listening to online conversation, I find myself saying, gosh, what if almost everybody just is really incapable of any kind of meaningful thought? But I don't think it has to be that way. And as a result of this belief that formed very long ago, and the self-perpetuating system, right? Everybody is dumb and helpless, and they need to be controlled by an elite group of human zookeepers. That's a self-perpetuating idea, right? Because once it's established, you look at maybe some of the more socialist societies in Northern Europe or Western Europe, and they are producing helpless people as they exist generation mm-hmm. after generation. But the history of our civilization is really an ongoing story of a small group of people controlling a large group of people by fear or by force. And this is almost always achieved by keeping most of the larger group relatively ignorant and hopelessly dependent on the supposed leadership of the smaller group. So religion proved to be a tremendously successful means of management for like thousands of years, right? That was a great way to control people and make them predictable. But eventually it failed to deliver real results, and science had to take over, as in the scientific management of human beings through the Prussian system, through the progressively reformed public schooling system in the United States. And that's basically where we are today. And I think that for the curious mind who cares about history and thinks it's real and thinks it affects us today, what's happened in the past, once that idea is made explicit, it really becomes impossible to ignore.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You said some very interesting things, and I want to touch on religion for a second. That it's still an issue in today's mm-hmm. society. We haven't really gotten past that. We haven't really evolved past that. There's always a different zeitgeist no matter what age we're in. The reason that religion is so powerful is because it deals with our fear. It deals with our fear of death. Everyone has an innate fear of death, and if we didn't, we wouldn't have a survival instinct. We have a survival instinct just like any other mammal, just like any other living thing on Earth. We want to survive. It's primal, and we're driven by it. So, of course, naturally, we have this fear of death. And, I mean, it might be at different levels. Some people might not fear it, like, in the same way that other people fear it. But
we know it's going to happen.
We're trying. Exactly. We know it's going to happen, but we try to avoid it because what we're really afraid of, Brett, is the unknown. We're not afraid of our lives ending. We're afraid of what happens after that. And I know that afraid is a different word, and some people might be thinking, well, I'm not really afraid of it, but we're all trying to avoid it. We don't take it very lightly. We do have a very primal, innate, and natural fear of the unknown, and that's what religion taps into. Religion provides us with a perceived response to what happens after we die, and it makes us feel better.
Yeah.
It deals with our fear. It makes us feel better. It's extremely powerful, and it's done through charismatic use of words. It's done through language. It's done through artful and skillful communication. This is how people are controlled, because we're swayed and we're seduced by this promise of comfort and this promise that everything's going to be okay if you abide by this criteria, if you follow these certain steps. But you have to always think about who's putting that out there, and most people don't. Most people don't dig deeper than the surface. Now ask yourself, Why don't they dig deeper than the surface? Because of information control. So behind religion, then, you have information control. If you're only given a certain amount of information from the time you're born, and if you're very cut off from discovering your own realities and your own truths about the world, then you're much more susceptible to believing whatever a perceived religious leader is going to tell you. So it always comes down to information control. And no, it's not new. I mean, let them eat cake. We all know that expression because it's very successful.
Yeah.
You give, and we're the small amount of people are running a large amount of people. Now, as far as potential for genius, our brains are our brains. We're all born with the same brain, minus physical deformities. We all have the capacity. We all have plasticity of brain power. We all have the intellectual capability of understanding. Our experience from the day we're born is going to alter the trajectory of our lives. We're going to go in different directions and our experiences are going to be unique, and you might have two people with very different ideas about the world, both considering themselves geniuses because they know a lot of information or they have high IQs based on some standardized test, or they're very good at math or what have you. Now, so that's a word that can be defined in many different ways, but the reality is, and I agree with you 100%, we all have the capacity. The capacity is suppressed. Is it suppressed purposely? Yeah, unfortunately it is. And it's nothing new. It's been going on since the beginning of time because this is just the nature of humanity. I do want to contribute this, though, Brett, and I have thought about this myself, and I think that some of what you were saying, you were struggling with this as well. There are times that I see what's going on in the world, and I see how people react, and I see how people respond, and I think about the leaders that we are faced, the choices that we are faced with right now to be quote-unquote political leaders, and I just think about the system that created this political pseudo leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And I am overwhelmed with a sense of hopelessness sometimes. And I think, gosh, maybe it's not true. Maybe we're not all geniuses. Maybe we're humanity. This is it. We're supposed to be controlled. We're supposed to be made to feel safe. We're supposed to be oppressed in this way. Maybe this is the way it's supposed to work because holy crap, things look really bad. So I am faced with those moments sometimes where I just kind of put my hand to my forehead and I say, oh gosh, is there any hope? But there's got to be.
Well,
there's got to be, because then I have conversations like this.
Right. Yeah. Well, thank you. Yes, I agree with you about that. I mean, unfortunately, there is a lot to be discouraged about right now, because we have, over the last 20 years or so, been observing the training wheels phase of new forms of human communication. Right. Whether it's mm-hmm. online through things like Facebook or YouTube comments, or even the 24-hour news cycle, like all of these things are relatively new. And there
are, you chuckled when you said that.
Yeah, there are some pretty significant and visible growing pains. Now, I think as far as something like IQ is concerned, there is going to be a 80 to 100 point IQ variance in the people who are born all over the world. If people believe that IQ is a legitimate measurement of intellect, I think that's something that people have to accept. Like, some people are going to be, born with an IQ of 70, and some people are going to be born with an IQ of 110, and some people get lucky and it's 130 or 140. But I think that if we look at those IQs growing up in these domination systems, it's fair to say that whatever it is, a lot of people are going to have a potential that they don't get to reach. Whether their IQ is 80 or whether their IQ is 120, that is probably going to be the facts as long as these systems of suppression still exist. But add to that these systems of suppression. You said let them eat cake, right? And I think mm-hmm. that I perpetuate this idea too much on the show, this kind of, and I did it in this conversation to say, oh, the idiots, let them eat cake, you know, at their circus, you know, that kind of a thing but this is where we could enter into the discussion, you know, one of your specialties, and even more specifically, nonviolent communication, the assessment and understanding of our own needs versus, the needs of other people, and realize that there's a lot of commonality there, even with the people that we consider to be the bad guys or the conspirators or the evildoers. If we move beyond
the right doing and the wrong doing, or the good and the evil, we see that it's about the achievement of the same needs. Of course there's going to be information control. If there wasn't, the maintenance of these systems would be incredibly dangerous. Just like I wouldn't have said in 2003 when I went into this shitty school environment, I really need everyone to behave today because I drank 12 beers last night because I hate my job and I'm miserable with my life. You know, like I would control certain kinds of information. And I think that's the same in these larger domination systems as well. And one of the biggest needs is security and comfort. People didn't choose to be born into an aristocratic class in America 100 years ago. But when they saw people flooding into this country who weren't part of that class, that was pretty terrifying. They were different colors. They didn't even speak the same language. And they're running down your street, you know, mm-hmm. knocking your top hat off. God, I would be scared, you know?
Yeah, of course. Of course. It's all born of a need. I mean, we can talk about conspiracy and we can label it evil, but everything that happens is born of a need, and everything that happens is the result of some sort of information control. And we all do it. You and I are doing it right now, Brett, because we talked about something before we turned our microphones on that we decided we're not going to talk about on air. So we're purposely avoiding a particular topic that we could be talking about. And in a sense, we are controlling that information because we're careful about what we put out there to the public. So to some degree, everyone contributes to information control. And I think once we embrace that and once we accept it, step outside, look at the landscape and look at the entire map for what it is, we can be a little bit more patient about what's going on in our society, even though there are negative aspects to it, even though there are controlling aspects to it, even though there are a lot of what we would consider to be evil aspects to it. We step outside of it and we realize, okay, well, let me define evil. Let's define evil on a grand scale. Let's define evil for myself. And everything is born of a need. There, I wish I had it in front of me. I can't remember the name of it. There was a children's book that I came across years ago when my children were younger. Because it was, it's a mediocre reading level, I guess, but it's really good. And I think it's called An Island Called Liberty.
Yes.
I think.
Yes.
Does that sound familiar to you? And
yeah.
What I really loved about that book is it really does illustrate how something always starts out as freedom, where we have this great idea and everyone's going to be free to do their own thing and everything goes really well, until the smallest thing happens and someone says, well, okay, that's an infringement. Let's just create some kind of regulation about that. And then it snowballs from there, but it kind of starts innocently. Now, I say that and some people might be thinking, but these people and these, you know, Rothschilds and Hildebergs and all these evil doers and these evil conspirators, did they really start with good intentions? I don't know, but they started with intentions that they thought were going to be the right idea at some point in time. We have all these negative things that we say about the Freemason Society, but if you work with any or if you know any people that are part of the Freemason Society, they think that they're doing great things for the world.
Yeah.
So there's always this kind of conundrum as far as intentions. And is there a need for structure or should we be in a society of anarchy? I don't know. And I've had the anarchy discussion too, and I'm still stuck in the idea that theoretically it's a wonderful principle and it's a wonderful concept, but I don't know that it's practical. I don't know that it will ever work until maybe hundreds of years from now when humanity has really evolved. But every time we're introduced with something new, like I love that you said we're in this training wheels phase of this new method of communication, because we really are. We've been introduced to the internet and Facebook and social media and YouTube and all these other ways that we can communicate with each other instantaneously, and we're devouring it, but we are in a training wheels phase of it.
Yeah.
We're learning how to use it effectively, and not all of us are using it effectively. Once we embrace that, once we embrace that there's so much we don't know, there's so much more to learn, we do all have the capacity and the potential to learn more, but we must be patient with humanity as a whole. We can't go around saying, everybody's stupid, everybody's an idiot, this is crazy, life sucks, because you know what? Sooner or later, it's going to be over, we're going to die, and then we'll figure out the rest.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we're still in a training wheels phase of self-contemplation and subsequent self-knowledge, but we still have this impulse to, you know, open our mouths and push air out in the form of words, and that doesn't always go well as
no,
a result,
it doesn't.
You know, or put our fingers to the keyboard, which is even more caustic a lot of the times, and do it that way.
So, yeah, I think that, gosh, this is the kind of thing I could get in trouble for saying, but a lot of these ideas that we're promoting with respect to the philosophy of liberty might have just arrived a little bit before their time. Now, in 2008, in 2012, the public success and the visibility of Ron Paul, I believe, created a kind of false sense of urgency. Like, oh, now our ideas are on the big stage. We got to get together. This is about to happen. It wasn't. You know, now here we are 4 years later in another presidential campaign, and we have a communist running against a fascist, right? So we backtracked a little bit nationally. and mm-hmm. I think that's okay. I think that these ideas are very powerful. The power of the ideas has converted a lot of people, even through somebody like Ron Paul, who was not the best messenger. You know, so it shows that they have a potency, but there's a lot of other things that have to be in place to really bring them into fruition. And I think part of it, and this is something that I try to work on every day, is being able to personally handle the responsibility of freedom. And, you know, that's emotional. That has to do with my relationships. That has to do with my work. That has to do with my finances. And all of those things are not sorted out yet. I've got a couple that I feel pretty good about, but there's a lot of work to do for me in all of those areas still. So I'm not in any rush. You know, I liked the idea of liberty in our lifetime. You know, that was an attraction to the Free State Project here in New Hampshire. But I'm realistic, and the more time I think we have to build a stronger foundation for true, complete liberty, I actually think the better off we're going to be.
Mm-hmm. I think what you're saying is very smart. I don't know that it was premature. I think the timing of it was right. But what's more important is, like you're saying, is patience. As a society, we need to be patient, because things like this take time. Things like this take time to happen and take time to build. This is not a concept that people are going to embrace on a large scale right away. There was a lot of success in the appearance of Ron Paul and in his message. He was not the best messenger. I was very, very compelled and drawn to what he was saying and the ideas of what he was saying. And because I am a good communicator, I was able to kind of read between the lines and forgive his delivery sometimes. But I also recognized how his delivery was a turnoff for some people. And those are ways in which I think his son might do a better job. He's simply a better communicator. He's a little bit more articulate and he can reach a wider audience. But at the same time, these are concepts that not everyone is going to agree with. Now, in the beginning, and a lot of folks that are like you and I out there, Brett, we might think, well, how could anyone not embrace the concept of personal liberty? How can anyone not embrace the concept of freedom? But the fact of the matter is that there are different people out there, and all of us have different experiences in our lives, and all of us have different experiences where our information was controlled and channeled into us in very different ways. So our education was different. The way we form our opinions is different. I have a very good friend that I work with on a regular basis that just out now considers himself a communist, and he will not a communist, a socialist. I'm sorry, that his political views are socialist, and he's proud of himself. And I will admit that that was shocking to me at first. How could anyone consider themselves a socialist and be okay with that and be proud of that? But I took the time to have a conversation with this person and to really get to know him and realize that this is not an evil person. This is a person that, because of his life experiences and because of the things that he has gone through in his life, and the paths that he has taken, he has decided that this defines his philosophy. We need to be able to have conversations with people that have had different experiences and realize that when people have opinions that differ from ours, they're not just trying to give us a hard time. They actually have had different experiences in their lives that led them to where they are. And until we can communicate with each other in a way that builds bridges instead of erecting walls and erecting barriers, we're not going to accomplish what we hope to accomplish. And what we hope to accomplish overall is peace. Will humanity ever accomplish that? I don't know, because I cannot think of a time in human history when there has not been conflict and has not been struggle for power. I really think it's an innate human thing to want to gain control over other people. And it's sick and it's unfortunate, but it's one of the fucked up elements of human nature, if you will.
Yeah.
And it's an element that we may just have to accept and learn to live with the best that we can in the most positive way. And it starts, like you were just saying, it was so brilliant. It starts with who we are. It doesn't start with who they are. It doesn't start with they have to change and adapt to the way we think. It starts with the way we think. And as cliche as it is, we have to be the example of the change that we want to see in the world. We have to start with our own behavior and the way we're communicating and the way we're connecting with other people, and think about what information was given to me that may have been contrived. What information can I rethink and say, should I consider an alternate perspective? Should I philosophize about my own thoughts and my own meaning and my own purpose in this world?
Exactly. You know, and as far as like who we are and what other people need to do, there might even be a way to constructively combine those things, right? So you meet somebody who identifies as a socialist but is a good person. I've certainly met people like that. And any good person who identifies as a socialist is just three or four good books away from embracing concepts like property rights and self-ownership, I believe. So then there's this question of, to use my friend Daryl Becker's language, how do you build the bridge to move those 18-wheelers of logic across? You know, if you don't have that bridge,
we're both after the same thing. It comes down to the basic human needs. We have a need to feel safe. We have a need to feel pleasure and avoid pain. We all want that.
Yeah. Right. Absolutely. And
that's
it comes
the
down.
First brick in building that bridge is identifying that we're after the same thing. Our ideas of how to get there are affected by our life experience and information control. But basically, we're after the same thing.
Hmm. I agree by and large. Yes, I think that is true. So I know you are out of time. I'm looking at pages of show notes that we didn't get to, but whatever. That was a great conversation. Thank
That's
you so much.
That's a promise that we're going to talk again.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I did want to flesh out some of what I covered in the intro regarding you know, the seven types of inner critic, the voice that is formed by the way adults, both in schools and at home, speak to children, and relate this to something that we've covered a lot on the show in the past. We did a series about adverse childhood experiences, internal family systems therapy, and not so much as a modality of therapy. We don't have to get into those details, but just there's some really valuable lessons in achieving greater self-knowledge that IFS provides. And that relates to the inner critics that I mentioned in the last show. So maybe that's something that we could do in a future conversation. I would love to hear your thoughts about that.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's plan that for a future conversation. Go ahead and send me the show notes that you have, and I'll take a look at them in advance. So maybe if I have them in my head in advance, I can control the information and just stay more on track along the lines of where we go. Honestly, I think all of the conversations that we have are useful. Mm-hmm. They are to me. I know that. And I hope that they're useful for eavesdroppers as well.
Mm.
Before we end, I have to mention this because it's been on my mind halfway through the conversation. It occurred to me, and I don't know how you feel about using current songs that are on the radio now, and as far as copyright or all that. But I would suggest, even if you don't use it as a music intro, that anyone that's listening, go ahead and look up the lyrics. One of my favorite contemporary songs and my favorite bands is AWOL Nation. I tend to lean toward musicians that use very good lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm into words and I'm into language. And it's one of the reasons why I always loved Eminem, because I really thought that he was a poet. I love 21 Pilots. One of my favorites is AWOL Nation, and they have a song called Kill Your Heroes. The lyrics to that song reminds me a lot of the conversation that we're having today. So I want to recommend that as the official song for today's conversation.
Absolutely. I will check it out as soon as we're done.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Lorette. Another great morning. You know, I was saying before we started, this is a little early for me. I don't know how sharp I'm going to be. Whatever. You know, I had a great time. This is a great way to start a day. So Thanks again.
Yeah,
and can you just...
Well, we always have great conversations because you're brilliant. I like I said, I am willing to experiment with late night conversations, but I want to warn your audience in advance. If I do that, my vocabulary is not going to be the same, but it could be interesting.
Yeah, sometimes it's okay to be a little bit spacey. Can you can you give your website for my audience again?
Yeah, real easy. LauretteLynn.com. It's LauretteLynn, not Loretta, but Laurette Lynn, LynnLynn. I am a professional talker and a communication specialist. I talk a lot about education, but I also talk about self-empowerment and bringing ourselves a better experience through deliberate and useful communication.
Awesome.
That's what I do.
Thank you so much. My site, if you're going to repost, is schoolsucksproject.com, and you can check us out on YouTube. Our username is School Sucks Podcast. And we can leave it there for today.
Yep. Bye-bye.
All right. We did it.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please help us out by leaving a positive review on iTunes. If you were angered by the show, please help us out by leaving negative reviews everywhere. If you think this is an important message for students, for parents, or for the future of intellectual freedom, please consider supporting us. SchoolSucksProject.com/AV. For $6 a month, you'll get access to hundreds of additional hours of content while helping us grow and spread this message further.